Hi, everybody. Mike Bloom here, about to bring you a very special edition of Post Show Recaps. Emphasis on show, because today we are discussing the recent Disney Plus release of the hit musical Hamilton. I got together with Shannon Gus, Amon Adwin, and Aaron Robertson to get into it all. But I want to put out a couple of quick disclaimers before curtain rises here. First, this is a spoiler-filled talk about the musical Hamilton. So, if you have not seen it yet, if you have not listened to the soundtrack yet, congratulations on living in a cave the past 5 years. But suffice it to say, no holds barred when it comes to talking about everything from this show. So consider this your warning. Secondly, I will admit out front, this is not a comprehensive breakdown of the show. In fact, we don't really go number by number or character by character or anything. It's more of an examination of the themes of the show, the stagecraft of the show, and the overall echoes that Hamilton has made in the world for the past half decade. So if you are into a more in-depth breakdown of the musical bit by bit, this is not going to be your jam. There is plenty of stuff out there that will offer that for you if you are into it. But this is going to be a much more general introspective discussion of Hamilton, the quote-unquote movie, the show, and the experience. That being said, I hope you're in for a very lively discussion. I thought there was a lot of great topics brought up over the next couple of hours. Please turn off your cell phones, unless, of course, you are listening to this on a phone, and enjoy the show.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
Hamilton on Disney Plus has just debuted, but we are just getting started. You do not have to wait for it here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. Mike Bloom here to discuss the musical monolith that has recently become a streaming sensation. Hamilton debuted on Disney Plus over the weekend, and I have assembled an all-star panel of founding fathers and mother to talk through this theatrical event in all its endeavors. Let me welcome everybody in. First, she is not only a Survivor superfan, but a Hamilton superfan as that. Screw the sequel. We're including her here in the original. Shannon Gus, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I think people who listen to this podcast might realize I don't do things in halves. You've met my Survivor obsession. You're about to meet my Hamilton obsession. And it's been a huge couple of days. I mean, to see Hamilton on TV, to kind of have the access to that, to be able to introduce it to members of my family and my in-laws who hadn't seen it. Like, I am just so thrilled that I have this all the time. And I don't know if I'll ever get anything done again. I'm just going to be watching scenes from the movie. It's an amazing thing.
Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda is very happy to have killed your productivity, or at least, you know, at least
what
in the temporary sense.
Very, exactly, very little exactly. To begin with. Can't blame him, but yeah.
Super happy to welcome this guy to Post Show Recaps and this Hamilton podcast in general. You know him from his work on Big Brother podcast as well as RuPaul's Drag Race. But today we're not talking about queens, maybe a king, but not many rulers. Amon Adwin, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm delighted to be a part of this podcast because it has finally driven me to watch Hamilton. Yes, a lot of people might be like, oh, what the hell? You've never seen it until now? It's been 4 years. What have you been doing this entire time? I didn't get a chance to buy tickets like a lot of other people on Broadway. So I'm finally able to watch it on Disney Plus, and has it lived up to the hype? I guess we'll discuss it.
Oh, man. Well, we will put a bobby pin in that. And finally, super happy to welcome this guy here to the podcast as well. You may know him from very recently from his excellent Karma recaps over on Reality TV or Hap Ups, as well as Once Upon a Time, this guy has been penning Hamilton themed wand-offs for the past several years. And he is definitively a better Aaron than Burr, Sir Aaron Robertson. Welcome. How you doing?
I am doing wonderful. And in fact, my friends, while this musical had hit its prime, told me that I should be playing George Washington. So clearly, you know, I shouldn't be playing Aaron at all. So I'm just going to take that out there.
Stay away from any character's name, Aaron, at least from the Hamilton capacity. So obviously, we got a lot to get into. I think we sort of discussed beforehand that we're going to use this as a way to discuss, obviously, the streaming version that just debuted on Disney Plus. But I think also using it as a lens to talk about the show in general, and especially the legacy that it's left in a very tempestuous 5 years, I'd say, in the country and the world. But I guess to start, and you know, Aman was alluding to it a little bit earlier, I think some people would be surprised to know that not only are all four of us, you know, whether newfound or old-found fans of Hamilton, but also, you know, fans and sometimes participants in musical theater in general. It's not all reality TV here, folks. So even to just start off, I would love to give, for lack of a better term, like a resume and your own experience with Hamilton, be it, you know, recent or more deep-seated. I can start. So I am someone, I feel like I've talked about this a few times. I am someone who was in the theater business for about 15 years, from about like age 8 until about my mid-20s, as both an actor, stage manager, production manager. I saw a lot of different sides of it. I have a degree in musical theater. That's what I went to school for. In terms of my relationship with Hamilton, I have the most fortunate and you know, manner origin story for this show, in that I was working for a college in the fall of 2015, and they just happened to be like, we're giving out, you know, discounted tickets to students and staff, and one of them happens to be the show called Hamilton from Lin-Manuel Miranda. It had been burning up the public, and it finally came to Broadway, and I snagged a couple tickets, and so myself and my lovely wife, Angela, got to see in October 2015 the original cast of Hamilton sans the spit bucket himself, Mr. Jonathan Groff. We had Andrew Rannells instead, but I consider that like one of the, you know, biggest lucky opportunities I've had in my life so far. And that really at that time, there had been some steam gathering, but not much in the larger perspective. And so I was very fortunately granted the opportunity to get to see it so early on in the run before things just really picked up the ball and everyone ran with it to the point where we're seeing it releasing on streaming. Aaron, why don't you go into your, you know, your not only history with Hamilton, but also your history with the world of the stage.
Yes. Stage has been associated with me since pretty much the very beginning. I remember being in third grade, and I went to, it was like a gifted kids school, and they had some after school classes. And I remember always being mad whenever people were reading aloud in class, because I'm like, you're not reading it with enough feeling. You're not, they're just like, you know, reading in monotone. And you, like, those of you who are students know exactly the tone that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And there was an after school class called All the World a Stage, and I was like, yes. And I remember playing King Claudius in Hamlet. You know, I played dead. It was great. And from there on, I had been doing musicals and plays ever since. I have two bachelors, one in music composition, one in theater. And I also worked in New York in theater for a bit, where I worked as an A2. So I, you know, made sure that the actors' microphones were all set and gave them their microphones. I did Phantom, the Yeston version. So I had to work with the Phantom a lot and make sure that the Phantom's mics were clear of sweat, because that Phantom sweat a lot. But and I have synesthesia, so I see music in color. So music composition and music has always been very prime with me. I remember seeing the Hamilton mixtape on YouTube when Lin-Manuel performed at the White House for the Poetry Jam. And that's when I first heard about it. I had loved In the Heights, and I was like, ooh, that's exciting. It was like, at first it was supposed to be an album, but then when it was a musical, I was like, oh, okay, I need to wait till I see it in theaters. And then that did not happen until a couple of days ago when I saw it on streaming. So I'm so excited that I finally got to see it. And the only times I had ever heard the songs were when I did the Wandoffs. So I guess I kind of spoiled myself for that, but I didn't really know the context of the songs in the musical. I was saving.
it's an interesting access point, and I can imagine you're probably watching it back being like, okay, this makes a lot more sense now. Now I don't need, now like, these are not the Goliaths, you know, these are actually three sisters instead of three random people on the same tribe.
Right. I was singing the Wandoff lyrics along when I was watching, though.
It's a nice, like, alternate version. Instead of the sing-alongs, do, like, the Wandoff sing-alongs. Shannon, what about you? What's your background and everything?
Well, my background in terms of music and musical theater is I've always been a performer and a songwriter. I have a Bachelor of Music in performance. In terms of musical theater, I mean, I played Simba in our fifth grade production of The Lion King, which is why I can still sing Hakuna Matata in Hebrew.
Oh, did Disney find out about that? Because they can come down pretty hard if you're not using their rights.
In Hebrew, though?
Oh, maybe you got away with it.
Yeah, I mean, Hakuna Matata just is Hakuna Matata. So very similar, but yeah, no, it was in Hebrew. But in terms of like my background, like everything I studied my final year of high school was drama, history, English, and music. I mean, that's pretty much Hamilton, right? So I was thinking like, why do I love this musical so much? And I'm like, well, my degrees are in music and media/writing. Like this is the peak of writing and music that exists in my lifetime. Like no wonder I'm obsessed with it. And in terms of finding Hamilton, I got to it pretty late. Like, it didn't hugely translate to Australia. It's the American musical. We're not a hugely theater-focused country as much as I try to see everything that comes here. But I think I heard a few bars of Satisfied on social media in 2018, and I was like, what is that? And I literally Googled the lyrics. I was like, this is amazing. And then I heard Helpless, and I was like, these songs are beautiful. Ended up listening to the whole soundtrack. And just loved it from listening to it. I came to New York in early 2019, was lucky enough to see it at the Richard Rogers Theater. And from there, my obsession only grew. I, you know, convinced my brother to become obsessed with it too. I quoted it in my wedding speech. He quoted it in his speech at my wedding. It's just a huge, huge part of my life. And then getting to see it a couple of days ago on Disney Plus again. And in the couple of days since, we'll talk about it. I've watched every piece of media and read every piece of media associated with this musical. And I think I'm at peak Hamilton right now. I'm literally wearing my Young, Scrappy, and Hungry t-shirt. So yeah, I'm at as peak Hamilton as we can go.
And Iman, what about you?
I love theater, guys. I figured that out similarly to Aaron when in school, and you know, the teacher would call on you to read to the class, and I always read everything with such gusto. I have a flair for dramatics. I have a flair for theatricality. It's just where I live. And I have been in at least one production every year of my life since sixth grade. Followed it through high school, followed it through college. And yeah, it's part of my DNA at this point. I think in like iambic pentameter. Like I just love everything theater and writing and everything. As far as Hamilton is concerned, so when I first got into theater, specifically into musical theater, one of the musicals that always kept, you know, coming to the forefront of the conversation that I hadn't seen back then either was Rent. Everybody would talk about Rent. They'd be like, oh my God, like all like, so, and I felt like such a latecomer to like theater at the time. And so I was like, oh my goodness, like this show that everybody keeps talking about it. What is it? 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 And sometimes you allow other people's hype to sort of like turn you off from the project because you're like, I'm not going to watch it because everybody else told me to watch. Cover. Oh, thank you very much. I don't need anybody else to tell me what's good. I have my own taste. I have my own, you know, sort of inclinations for things. And so I kind of found myself having a similar battle with Hamilton when it came out. So it's no secret that it took the world by storm in 2015, 2016. Everybody's talking about it. It won a shit ton of Tony. Everybody in the show was nominated for something. And I was just like, I have to see it, but I don't see how I can see it because Broadway is sold out until like the month of May in 2030. Like, I don't like, when am I going to be able to see this damn show? And then like my parents went and saw it. They loved it and they're not like big musical theater people. So I was like, okay, that's a little strange. And then the next thing I know, both my dad and my little sister listen to the soundtrack every day after school to the point where my little sister knows this sound. She's 12. She was what? That means she was, what's the math there? She was 8 at the time and knew the entire Hamilton soundtrack before I did. And I'm like, okay, something's okay, so some people aren't making a joke out of this. This must be really, really good. And so I finally sit down to watch this for Disney Plus, and my mom was like, oh, come on, like, you're just not, it's just not going to be the same to you. Like, you need to go sit in person. Like, you're just not going to like it. And I'm like, Mom, do you realize who you're talking to? Like, you came to see me in shows. Like, I am the theater person of this household. How dare you try and tell me that I'm not somebody that's going to understand musical theater and it's not going to translate well to me through Disney Plus, like, no less. Like, Disney freak at that point. Like, it's like, what are you, like, come on. And so I sit down and I watch this and I'm like, okay, I get it. I wish that I had been a part of the train through the past 4 years. Like Shannon said, it's peak writing, it's peak musicianship, it's peak artistry, and it's a musical for people that don't like musicals, and it's a musical for people that love musicals. And it's just, it's Hamilton, and it's really, really good. And I am so fortunate to, like, have been alive and a theater goer and a theater lover during, like, Hamilton's prime. It's just, yeah. So I'm excited to talk about it. It's going to be a good conversation. Yay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. It really is a musical for everyone. And for me, because I'm in Australia, I don't know anyone who likes Hamilton who's not kind of going to like that thing before now. You know, like, I love it, but I'm gonna love it. You know, people who happen to have been overseas, who've seen it, they love it. My brother, who's a big history buff and musical theater buff, he loves it. That is not surprising to me. But then I sat down and I watched the Disney Plus. I watched it with three people. I watched it with my husband and my in-laws. And I was like, I know my mother-in-law is gonna love it because she loves musical theater. I know my husband's gonna at least try to love it, because he wants to make me happy, and he did love it. But I was like, there's no way my father-in-law is going to love this. He doesn't like rap. He doesn't like musical theater. He already gives me grief about all of the shows I've made him watch, like all of these, like, high-quality, you know, good on Rotten Tomatoes shows and movies. And he loved it. He actually credited me back Hail Caesar, which he hated that I made him watch. So I was like, okay, this might be for everyone. And now I kind of get the phenomenon that it's accessible and people do love it, and you don't have to be the kind of person who'll love Hamilton because everyone will find something in it, and it also is just that entertaining. So that was really cool for me to see. I know it's a phenomenon, but to see it with my own eyes and to see people enjoy it in front of me was really thrilling.
And that's why I think that, you know, I think there are certainly merits as to, you know, sort of to your mom's point, I'm on this idea of, like, when you release recorded pieces of theater and not just, like, the handy cam from the balcony bootlegs of Waitress that we've all seen on YouTube once upon a time, like, legitimate, let's do this whole setup and film this almost like a film. You do feel like there might be some potential loss of, like, being there in an audience and actually experiencing the energy. But that being said, the importance of the accessibility, in my opinion, with this supersedes that live element. I mean, we can certainly talk about the actual filming of the show. I think it was, you know, pretty well done, considering there is so freaking much going on at that stage at the same time. There really is. You have to sacrifice certain corners of the stage in order to focus on other ones from a single camera aspect. But I think that what the show is able to do, and the fact that even back during its initial days on Broadway with the whole, like, ham for ham movement of we're going to give away $10 tickets, it really try to buck the Broadway brand in a number of ways, one of them being this sort of accessibility ceiling, right? This idea of, well, Broadway can only really be experienced by those who have the change and those who have the time and the ability to access it. And this is a show that is trying to not espouse that, to be like, look at these people who were able to build themselves up from nothing and be able to make things important happen, and to say, let's not make this a classist type of thing. And so I think putting it on a service like Disney Plus, and you know, the story is that this was supposed to be released in theaters, I think, like, end of 2021. They bumped it up. This is talked about in a documentary that Shannon mentioned that pops up from the Undefeated show from ESPN on Disney Plus, just about the making of the show. It's this idea of, you know, this is a time to have people be able to access the messages of this show and what this show represents. It's something that supersedes a ticket price or supersedes the ability to see it live, because it does immerse you in a certain perspective. The words and the music do surround you, and the choreography surround you, even if you're sitting at home, to make you believe those words, so that, you know, when
push comes to shove, in a manner of speaking, you are able to go out there and make good in the world because you've seen people, you know, write and fight their way out based on something that you did not need to pay $300 to see.
Yeah. And that's why absolutely. I feel emotional about the accessibility almost, because for me, like, it's been so important for me for the last couple of years because those have been the two most transformative years of my life. You know, like, I've been in the podcast world and I moved and I got engaged and then married and like all of these things. And like Hamilton has been the soundtrack to that, which is odd because it is about the American Revolution. And I'm a random Australian person who is not in the 18th century. But at the same time, like, it has all of these universal themes. Like I always say, you find in it what you need, and I've needed it. I find in it the song I need. You know, I'll listen to One Last Time when I'm going through change. I listen to Helpless when I got engaged. I listen to It's Quiet Uptown when I'm dealing with loss or with fear. You know, I find everything in it that I need, and it brings me clarity and it brings strength or it brings a lesson. And then, as you said, it's even beyond my introspection. It's about being part of something bigger, being something bigger than yourself, which is so important at this time. So I think a lot of people are about to find something that they really need that they can have whenever they want. And there's no barrier to that. And I think that is such a beautiful thing, that how many people just A, became lovers of theater is really cool, but B, just found a piece of art that's going to change their lives and kind of cement things and clarify things and all these things that they need. And it's available whenever they want. Like, that's so cool to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not just about who lives, who dies, who tells your story. It's also about who receives your story, who has access to your story. And the fact that there are very few pieces of theater that have been as accessible as Hamilton has been, it's been amazing to see, you know, a musical that can be received across all forms, whether you're just listening to the soundtrack, whether you are watching it live in the theater, or whether you're sitting at home, you know, in your PJs with a bag of popcorn watching it on Disney Plus. You know, there's so many ways to receive this, and I feel like each way has its own impact. And that whole picture together really kind of culminates the whole Hamilton experience. And I, even just seeing it from Disney Plus, that was one of 1,000 performances that has been done of Hamilton. And I was just watching it on my couch, and I can only imagine what it must have been like actually experiencing it in person, and even watching a performance that, you know, where everybody's on the top of their game, you know. And that's just made me appreciate this a lot more, just from seeing what we've seen on Disney Plus.
I mean, I agree with what everyone has just said. And I mean, that feeling of being a part or witnessing something that is larger than you and like speaks to a greater, you know, a larger narrative for everyone is something that I felt was like very pervasive throughout the entire performance. And it's something that I have always, something that I've been addicted to when performing on stage. It's like, you come together with the rest of these people and you tell this story to a bunch of other people, and you want to see some sort of like shift in that person's life, right? That's what people do. That's what people are artists in general, is because they want to shift people's consciousness. They want for people to understand something on a deeper level, whether it be something about themselves or whether it be something about someone else. And I think that Hamilton really is a vehicle for that, especially in the year that it came out. I mean, there is a reason that artistry is at its peak during election years. Like, political unrest, political turmoil breeds such pain, but such beautiful artistry. And I think that this is like just a hallmark calling card for that. So Hamilton is just I mean, what else can we say? Like, it's just, it's so good.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, you know, bringing in the visual element, because obviously a lot of people gain accessibility to this through just listening to the soundtrack. And suffice it to say, there are so many things that are not literally heard on the soundtrack that are brought into the visual. And that's another thing as well, is that I really do feel like, you know, I'm definitely that theater type that's like, I don't like to listen to the soundtrack before I go to shows, because either you spoil yourself, You're so concentrated on like the performance.
I have to listen to the soundtrack before.
Well, the Hamilton would be one of the exceptions because, again, I got to see it when it was relatively new. I don't think actually the Broadway soundtrack had even come out yet. I think it came out a couple months after I had seen it.
Oh my God.
And I was so like delighted, but so overwhelmed because I feel like, and I would love to hear from you, from especially from like Aaron and Aman, who had not seen the show before up to this point, but like Andy Blankenbuehler's choreography to me is such an essential part of taking in this show that, yeah, I sometimes forget that like people just take in the music and the beautiful words and the melodies without even realizing all the shit that's going on the stage. There is so much. It's almost like an entirely different story is being told. And there's everything is going on from all corners at the same time that while overwhelming to experience in person, it adds a brand new layer to what's already an extremely layered show.
Yeah. I'm similar, Mike. I don't like to listen to shows beforehand because I like to just be able to experience everything in the way that the artist intends for me to experience it, not to sound like a snob or whatever. That's just a kind of like how I like to consume things. I'm glad that I hadn't heard the entire soundtrack because I live in musical theater, so a lot of my friends had already seen it or I had already listened. So they were always playing this damn album, and I'm like, oh my God, I cannot escape this shit. Like, I'm never going to be able to see this now because I keep hearing all the songs everywhere. So I was very familiar with a few songs. So I did find myself like bobbing, like, oh, this is the context of that song. Yes, okay, I get it. Skylar Sisters, yes. I remember like feeling that way. But yes, with the choreography and the visuals, combined, I was like, yeah, this is, we spent an entire unit on tableaus in one of my theater classes in college where we literally just had to tell a story by little vignettes of still frame, like as if we're taking pictures of one another. And I feel like Aaron Blankenbuehler's choreography really does that. Like, it's not like your regular run of the mill kickball change, you know, syncopated choreography. It's a lot of images that sort of like just breathe and come alive and tell a story and are a part of the music. And that's something that it's like kind of like Fosse, but like elevated, if that makes sense.
And it reminds me of like, I think it's Brecht who came up with the idea of like the montage, right? Of like creating visuals through a series of like tableau-esque, as you mentioned, poses and sort of basing gestuses and physicality off of that. I totally agree that that's a really great comparison.
Well, I was just listening to Lin-Manuel Miranda on the Hamilcast, and he was talking about how the choreography is completely rooted in story. And he's like, Andy is as obsessed with narrative as I am. Like, he won't put in anything superfluous. Every single thing is done to support the story. So for me, as someone who did listen to the entire soundtrack before I originally saw it, listened to it 1,000 more times since then until I saw it 2 days ago again, I feel like it is the kind of thing where you can listen to the soundtrack and understand it. I feel like the choreography hugely elevates it, but it doesn't actually change anything. So it's not the kind of thing that you won't understand if you're listening to, or that you'll kind of miss something. There were a few things that were changed to me in watching the film, even from having seen it live, which we can talk about. But in terms of the choreography, I think it adds to it, but it, without changing anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just the visuals alone completely got me. And I think theater is all about suspension of disbelief. And I think, you know, music is one thing, but when you add the music and the sound and the movement and the lighting and just all of the technical elements that are involved, I think it creates a really beautiful picture. And that's why for me, the moment where I was like, oh, okay, this is where I could see why it was satisfied. Yes. When I saw that for the first time, I heard Angelica say rewind, and then the sound, and then the movement, and then the music of them like going in reverse of the lines that we just heard. I was so blown away by that. I could not contain myself. And it's little moments that compound upon themselves to create something so awesome. And I remember in college when we did a creating musical theater class and having to come up with different ways each week of being able to tell a story, and just thinking about how long it took to pull all of these elements together. I mean, this show in itself is very well crafted upon itself. And I remember paying attention to, I believe she's referred to as the Bullet, that ensemble member.
Yeah,
that
is, Ariana DeBose, I think her name is.
Yeah. And just her movements with the Bullet and being killed. And I just, it was, I can't even describe in words just how beautiful those moments were to watch and just how hard that is to come up with technically and put all those ideas together and get it to be pulled off in such a way that it's accessible to everybody, but still carries the essence of what the show is.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of the Bullet, you know, in case anyone doesn't know what that's about, you know, it's that the cast member who is literally the Bullet going from Burr to Hamilton, but it's also the first person killed on the show after King George comes on for You'll Be Back. And I was reading a thread today about the Bullet because you miss so much of what she's doing. You know, she's flirting with Philip before he dies. He's literally flirting with death.
Flirting with death.
She hands Burr the quill to write to Hamilton. Like that's why I love the show, because I hate things that are thoughtless. And this is like every moment, every line, every movement has extreme thought put into it. You could break it down to seconds and analyze every one of them. And the Bullet is such a good encapsulation of that.
Yeah, and I think it even comes down to casting. The doubling of roles is something that, like, I was really thinking about, you know, even after the first time I saw it, which I will just say, you know, what I'll admit, when I was watching the show for the first time, I was like, okay, this is fun, I'm enjoying this. But the moment for me, as Aaron mentioned, was Helpless into Satisfied.
Which is weird, because that's what made me obsessed with it musically. So, like, that seems like a big moment for everyone.
Well, it's not only the fact of, like, the rewind of it all, but, like, when you see them literally go through the same choreography as Helpless, but now framed from Angelica's perspective, is so interesting to me. How it's that Rashomon, right? It's this idea of, like, seeing things from a different person's perspective, and considering it's the most immediate events, it's such a cool way to show the perspective of somebody who we really hadn't seen up to that point whatsoever. Eliza just had her big moment, and we thought that Angelica was the one that was helping her along the entire time. So to hear that and see the stagecraft behind it, there are other small things like, having Mariah Reynolds be there visible in the background of the Reynolds pamphlet the entire time, despite not saying something, or like King George being part of the Reynolds pamphlet as well, even though you would not know that from listening to the soundtrack. But yeah, so going back to the doubling of it all, it's just, there's so many fantastic elements to it. This idea that, you know, some of Hamilton's closest friends in the actors that play Lafayette and Hercules Mulligan in Act 1 become his biggest enemies in Act 2. That the poor characters played by Anthony Ramos both die and they sort of serve as compatriots to it. That, you know, you're like, okay, why is Peggy part of Me, I Loved Him? And then you find out about Mariah Reynolds in Act 2. Like, there's a nice thematic lining in each of the casting as well, where occasionally you're finding these shows that have like doubling or tripling casting. Well, they just have another body on stage. They're just going to like throw somebody out another wig to play this. But the characters that each of these people play, it's almost like a track instead of a character, right? Like David Diggs' track is so interesting in terms of how Lafayette and Jefferson compare to one another, and the different roles that they serve in Hamilton's life, in terms of both of them are sort of propelling him along, but almost for completely different reasons.
When I saw that, one of the first musicals that I actually thought of was Children of Eden, which has a similar mechanic where in the first act we see, you know, the conflict between God and Adam and Cain and Abel, and then we see that reflected with the same actors, but this time playing Noah and his family, and that whole conflict about the ark. And I just really, you know, appreciate shows that can, it's where actors play characters that have similar arcs in dual acts, can kind of really say a lot about the show and connect everything together and make everything feel complete, and make it easy for people to identify as well. You know, they can look at David and go, oh, okay, that's the guy that's associated with France. You know, because Jefferson was tight with France, and then Lafayette was, you know, just that whole thought process. Great job on them for being able to pull that dual track or triple track off.
But, and you know what I love about that as well, is that the first time we see someone come back as a new character is obviously David Diggs coming in as Jefferson, and just the little details, you know, it's in the music. You haven't met him yet. you know, just to kind of catch everyone up to speed. That's at the beginning of What Did I Miss? So there's so much details like that. I was listening to, as I said, the Hamilcast today, and they were talking about that helpless, satisfied double choreography. And they were saying, you know, the first time Angelica and Hamilton see each other is actually in the middle of a winter's ball. That's how far back they go. They don't even just repeat the song, which most musicals would do. They don't go all the way back to Helpless. They go back half a song before that as well. So there's all of that kind of like complicated detail, you know, in watching parts of it again today. I think I could probably watch this 100 more times, and just as I do with listening to the music, and pick up little different things every time. So I'm, that's why I'm like, I said to Peter today, I'm like, I don't even care if I never watch anything else on Disney Plus. I literally got an account to watch Hamilton, and like, I'll keep the account just to watch Hamilton repeatedly. It's such a good deal for me.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those shows that is a feast, right? They like, they want for you to come back and see something entirely different. And that's just like the, I mean, you're already going to get that with theater anyway, you know what I mean? So when you have a piece of theater that is specifically like chock full of detail, it's like, oh, I mean, I found myself thinking like, how, like, do I nominate David Riggs for the Marquis de Lafayette? Do I nominate him for Thomas Jefferson? Like, where does the nominee, I don't understand the nomination process. Like it's crazy. And like, just, I mean, not to berate this too much, but like, I just have to talk about the satisfied and the helpless shit, because man, oh man. And then that rotating disc, that sort of like,
not to mention, because like a turntable has become like a facet of modern theater, right? Like it was popularized with Les Mis, but what I love about it is it's three concentric circles. It's three different turntables. And from above, it looks like a target. So even that, like the symbolism behind that.
Oh, I didn't even catch that. See,
wow.
So, but like, you know, it's in when it's moments like helpless or not helpless, like Say No to This, where you have like Hamilton in the center and you have Burr walking on the middle platform and then Mariah Reynolds on the second one. Like it allows some really fantastic movement as well. Because obviously the hardest thing that happens on stage is like, okay, you have what, 20 feet. Figure out how to make locations happen. But this really allows for some really new movement where, like Amon said, like you're able to really strike those tableaus, but we see a different angle every second because it's rotating at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there's some stuff that I'd love to talk about from the film before we talk about like the broader things in the musical itself, because for me, there was like, so there was a couple of things I felt was different. Like one thing, 5 a.m., the night I watched it, I was like up and I was like shook to my core, because I've always, in listening to it and even having seen it live, I've always seen Burr and Hamilton as a central conflict. And I do still believe thematically that that's true. But what kind of struck me watching it, I was like, I feel like Burr is like completely insignificant to Hamilton. I was like a new way of looking at it for me, which was interesting having a seen it live and listened to it so many times. But I think just like watching it and being so in it when you're watching like it close up and as a movie, I was like, Burr is obsessed with Hamilton. That I know is true.
I mean, he's literally the narrator of his story.
Yeah, exactly. Fine. Okay, so I kind of get that. But Hamilton, I was like, I feel like Hamilton's main rival is Jefferson, and he's got a million other things going on, which is like maddening for Burr. So at first I was like shook by that story being really different to how I envisioned it, because I really center Burr. I love Burr is the first thing as a character. I listen to his song so much that for me, he's so central in Hamilton's story. And I just kind of felt like Hamilton just like really doesn't care that much, does he? As certainly not even a tenth as much as Burr does. So for me, I was just like, this is a very different way of looking at it for me. And I don't know, Mike, if you had anything where, having seen it, having listened to it, having been involved in it, did anything kind of shift for you in watching it in the movie?
Yeah, so I mean, also, you know, I hadn't seen it in like 5 years or so. So obviously a lot of stuff is like reawakening images, and a lot of it was, wow, I didn't notice that because I was paying attention to like everything else going on. I think I tried to pay attention this time as much to the ensemble as I could. It's really tough to divide your attention, but again, that ensemble is so purposeful in what they do, and they are also the ones that really take the brunt of Andy Blankenbuehler's choreography. And I, you know, I watched a couple of like demos that he did around 2016 about how purposeful that movement is, and how, you know, even just look at like the choreography from My Shot, and like every single move has intentionality, every single step has a reasoning behind it. So I really tried to pay attention to that. There were things that I forgot, you know, because I listened to the album after I watched the show. And I think a really interesting omission that I would love to hear, you know, Aaron and Amon's thoughts on, or Tomorrow There'll Be More of Us, which is essentially Lauren's death that is completely omitted from the album. Lin-Manuel Miranda said that, you know, he said it because it was more of a scene. It's probably the most like spoken we get out of this sung through musical. But I think it's an interesting omission because it does also serve as like a surprise if you don't know. Because obviously Philip's death gets spoiled. Hamilton's death obviously gets spoiled through the album. But Lauren's death really does not go talked about. But if you think about it, it's a fantastic through line into Nonstop, which I sort of realized this time around where, you know, Eliza says, or I guess the letter says that, you know, he died trying to emancipate a bunch of slaves and his, you know, mission dies with him. And I do feel like that fuels a lot of Hamilton to be like, okay, if I only have so much time on this earth, let me work to get done what I need to. And I feel like that's a fine tracker from, you know, Yorktown into Nonstop. But I feel like including There'll Be More of Us, Tomorrow There'll Be More of Us, is more of like an immediate cause to action rather than just, well, the war is over, so what do I do now?
Yeah, it was because I saw a couple of articles written about the relationship between Lawrence and Hamilton and how there were a few musing as to whether or not Hamilton might have swung a little bit both ways. Mm-hmm. Like, was there something a little bit more to the relationship than they let on? So the fact that it was omitted from the album, which I didn't know because I still haven't listened to the album in full. The fact that it was omitted from that kind of is like interesting to me. It sort of like kind of like speaks to the greater narrative of like that sort of being something that is not as pronounced in the legacy of Hamilton. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, I think it's so, that's a really fascinating point that you make about that being removed from the album, because I do think, as someone, again, listening to the album all the time, and my seats were like really back row when I saw it, so I don't get the nuance that I did in watching it. And one of the main things I got in watching the film was how heavy-handed and non-subtle the relationship between Lawrence and Hamilton was, the romantic relationship, I thought. I mean, in the soundtrack, all we're getting is, Lawrence, I like you a lot. But in terms of the looks and the fact that walking down the aisle during Helpless, Angelica and Lawrence are, you know, arm in arm walking down the aisle, and they look at each other kind of like with a little bit of disgust. You know, the man they love is getting married. Then Lawrence comes back blind, drunk. Like, it's pretty clear in playing it out where it's not on the album. So I actually hadn't thought about that point where you're saying it is a little bit erased from the music to leave out his death and how important that was and how heartbreaking that was for Hamilton, as much as he doesn't show it. Because yeah, it doesn't come across, that relationship does not come across on the album the way that it did in the film. And that's another thing I'm grateful for in terms of getting this detail.
Oh yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I was like, I like what you said, Mike, about how it sort of like was an immediate call to action for him. He kind of, as soon as he doesn't even want to read the letter. He thinks it's just, you know, Lauren just talking, and then he realizes, oh, he's been killed, and then he immediately just throws himself into his work. And it's like, yeah, I think that is a very like, it's a way of showing this is obviously a big driving force for why he chooses to live the rest of his life the way that he does without really saying that it is. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, we get it. He's heartbroken. He's pushing forward. This is impactful for him. And so I thought that was a nice and subtle way to do it.
Yeah. And to do the reverse of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that I was surprised to see in the film that most likely wouldn't be in a soundtrack is just the general theatrical experience. I was surprised to hear audience sounds. I was surprised to hear King George's speech, you know, the silence all your cell phone speech. I was surprised we had an intermission.
Yeah.
I literally gave the TV screen a standing ovation when I saw intermission. I paused. I made some food. I came back. I was so happy.
Yeah, I literally treated like there was an intermission. I went to the bathroom. I did everything. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, they really wanted to, like, I think that's really what Lin was concentrating on, right? It was like, as weird as it is to put a camera in front of these people, is like, we want to bring in the theatrical experience. I will say personally, was the actual direction of the film like sublime? It was fine. I think they were trying to do what they did. There were some awkward moments, at least from my perspective, where like they would do weird cuts during certain moments of like you know, to two or three people while one person's singing. So it's not perfect, but I feel like it did. I mean, listen, if a couple of people who hadn't seen the show before said it pretty much encapsulated like the experience from their perspective, who am I to quibble? But I speaking of moments that were not on the album,
yep.
We got to talk about the final gasp.
Yep.
We got to talk about the sound that the show ends on, which is in Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story, ends with Eliza Hamilton on stage. And she ends the show by looking up or out, depending on the way you're looking at it. And she tearfully makes like a gasp and almost like an exultation of an exhale, for lack of a better term. And there's been a lot of talk over the years of people who saw it as to, you know, what that meant. Because, again, that's missing from the album. It just ends on this very like, you know, slow, held note in unison between the cast. But I feel like watching her actually experience that moment, however you perceive it, completely, Shannon, in my opinion, changes your understanding of the ending.
Yeah, and for me, I didn't remember my Eliza doing it. I was like, how dense am I that I missed this? Then I found out not all Elizas do it. All Elizas choose if they will, how they will, and what it will mean based on their connection to the character. So I was like, okay, I guess my Eliza just didn't do it, or I missed it. I'm not still not really sure what happened there. But that's what that moment to me is just beautiful and perfect for so many reasons. There's a couple of interpretations. You know, one, she's seeing Alexander, which she does see on stage. I don't love that interpretation because I feel like she wouldn't be shocked to see him. But anyway, or is she seeing her loved ones on the other side? Is she seeing God? All of this, I mean, Philippa Sue herself has said it's basically a general transcendence. And she, I guess, can choose every night what that transcendence is. But the one that I love and the one I'm taking as canon because it's so perfect, that I think a lot of people take as canon, is that she is seeing the audience. And it's breaking the fourth wall, as the musical often does. I mean, it's literally being narrated to us. And seeing the fruits of her labor, her entire life's work, to get Hamilton to have a legacy. And she did, because we're here listening to it and she's telling it to us. And I love that for so many reasons. Firstly, it just encapsulates the themes of narrative and legacy, which Eliza largely carries throughout the show. I mean, it's a big part of all the characters, but she is right in the middle of all that. The second thing is that the show is so meta, and Hamilton's legacy was like fading a little bit before it came along. He was about to be taken off the $10 bill, and he literally wasn't because of the popularity of the musical. So yes, the musical has space in his legacy that's really significant. So this is relevant too. And another thing I love about that moment, whatever you take from it is a testament to how we live in the story, right? Like, the story is timeless. We're all in the story. History has its eyes on us constantly. And how much is the story a living, breathing thing that the final moment, one of the major talking points that everyone has on their mind, is not in the script. It's not in the soundtrack. It's not something that was planned for the musical, and it organically came up, and it comes up differently each and every time with each different Eliza that stages it. That, to me, is just like the beauty of living, breathing theater that nothing else can give. And I love the way it was done for the film, and I think it's just a perfect way to end on in terms of it stops from ending on a full stop, and it makes it a question mark or a dot, dot, dot. And that, to me, is just great art.
Mm.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you always, like, I think that you should strive for having ambiguity in your show, not to the point of nauseam where it's like, oh my God, anything goes, right? But like to the point where you are having something for your audience to take away and chew on. And I personally like the interpretation that she is seeing the audience and she understands that the story that she's been dying to tell about Hamilton is now being, it's seen, you know what I mean? And that's, which, you know, sort of like harkens back to the conversation we were having earlier about how theater really needs to be accessible so people can see these stories. So I just, yeah, I did not know that that was something that was like up for debate. And so doing a little bit of research, and now I'm like even more pissed off that I haven't been on the hype train. Cause like, I feel like I'm not growing as much
time
with everyone.
It's amazing.
I'm
better
right
late
there
than
with
never.
You. I'm like, why did I wait so long? I just was so, I just felt like this was something that really needed to be experienced either live or in the theatrical form. So
yeah,
I totally can understand a lot more into the last several years of our lives into the impact that Hamilton has had.
Yeah, and I also love in terms of her ending on something beyond time and rationality. Whatever she's seeing, is she seeing loved ones on the other side? Is she seeing God? Is she seeing us? Either way, that's beyond the physical. And I think that that's a really big theme of the musical as well, because, you know, this is like today, yeah. I spent a lot of today, I had it in my mind, I was like, I get in the musical why Burr shot Hamilton, kind of get that in general. But why did Hamilton not shoot Burr? Like, I get it, his son died. But why didn't he shoot back? Why did he waste his shot? And I was like, you know, doing a lot of, historical research into it. Then I pick up the book that I'm reading, Hamilton, The Revolution, read two pages where Lin-Manuel Miranda is basically like, look, the research you did is useless. It doesn't matter. It's not a whodunit. The point is it's vague and it's messy because life is vague and messy. It's meant to be, you're meant to interpret it how you interpret it. The actors are meant to interpret it differently every time. Leslie Odom Jr. said that he treats Burr's motives different every night. So here I am like an idiot trying to work out the exact motive and put it into a neat little package, but it can't. And that's the point, because it's meant to be vague and beyond the physical and beyond the rational. And I think ending the musical on something like that can be debated and interpreted, it speaks to the very, you know, soul of the musical, which is in, let us take what we want from it. You know, it's not all about these historical figures. It's not, as they say in Hamilton's America, which I also watched last night. I'm like filled to the brim with a lot of Hamilton content right now. It's a great documentary from 2016. But they say it's not like, you know, a history book with songs attached to it. It's not that. These characters are what they did, but they also mostly are what Lin-Manuel Miranda invented them to be, and then what the actors interpret them to be, and then what we take from it too. And in all of those levels, there's going to be interpretations, and having the musical end on the biggest, one of the biggest things we can interpret and debate, again, perfect for the theme of the musical.
Well, that's the thing about not even the soul of Hamilton, but the soul of theater. Yeah. At least from what I always enjoyed as a performer is that every performance ideally should be different. That's why I personally am not a fan of, you know, the licensed version of West Side Story requires you use Jerome Robbins' choreography. Like, I don't necessarily like this idea of, oh, if you do Les Mis, you have to have someone waving the red flag. I think that interpretation is the most beautiful element of theater, from a performative perspective, from a design perspective, from a directorial perspective, because it really is a piece of theater is an elephant, and we are all blind men touching different parts, trying to feel like what that means to us. And I think when you sort of regiment things, and I hope if and when Hamilton does get licensed, they don't come in with, okay, you have to do things like this, because I think that sort of loosens the ability for people to really do things the way that they want to. And that speaks from a performative perspective, what you're just saying, Shaden, where I think if you are someone who walks in like, okay, this is why Burr did what he did, if you're doing that 8 times a week for like a year and a half, that is going to get so boring and so dull. Mm-hmm. And your performance as a result becomes less enthused. It just becomes like you're a train on a track. And so I love this idea that like they're discovering things just like the audience is, because that's going to inform their performances even more.
Yeah, but yeah. I also think sticking to an exact narrative is like anti what Hamilton is trying to say, you know, because the whole point is like narrative is flawed. That's like the whole point of the musical, right? Like, this is what I was looking up today. It's like, why did Hamilton go to the duel? Like, was he committing suicide? Was it martyrdom? Was he trying to kill Burr? Was he provoking him? Was it peace? It's like, it's all of those things and it's none of those things. Like, that's the point. And everything that we can even know and nail down that's not, you know, from the perspective of someone who dies in that moment, this whole musical is told, as we've seen, from the privilege. So it's, you know, it's an unreliable narrator. There are holes in the story that the musical very playfully engages with, the room where it happens. We don't know. Eliza burned the letters. We don't know what happened. That's the whole point. It is kind of this, like, again, living, breathing thing that you can take from what you want. It's not nailed down. And even if it was, I wouldn't trust the people nailing it down. So to kind of have something so definite, I would think that Hamilton wouldn't kind of give something that definite, because the musical in itself is more vague, and that's kind of the point.
I love when theater is able to breathe and have so many different interpretations. I mean, you know, saying something like, I'll always be satisfied, or I'll always be satisfied. You know, there's just so many different meanings you can get just from one line, and as an actor or somebody performing, being able to embody those interpretations every night, depending on, you know, the vibe I'm getting from the audience, something that I'm noticing, something, you know, interacting with the other performers, you know, what are they giving off, and how do I, you know, and and basically living out life on stage in a fluid form that sends, you know, transcendent messages to an audience every night. I just think theater is something that is so, it's so, it's universal like music. I think it's something that can bring people together because it's something that transcends boundaries and that a lot of people can gravitate towards and understand and connect with.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's speaking to like both your points, Mike and Shannon. Like, I think history is nebulous, right? Like, there's this quote that my dad always used to say to me, which I think about all the time, and it's that until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. And like the very fact that like she like Eliza is like focused on guarding this legacy of Hamilton for so much of her life, it just sort of like, I mean, it's sort of like, what's the point of that? Because people are going to interpret it for what they may, regardless of whatever it is that you're putting out into the universe. Like, the story will be told, the story will be heard, and it of course, like, messaging is very important, and it really depends on like who tells the story and like how it is received. But at the end of the day, because of the fact that everybody has a part in this, like, Aaron Burr is also going to talk his shit, Angelica is also going to talk her shit. Like, everybody that has a part, that has a role in this, is going to have something to say. And it is that wider, that broader, like, story that coalesces from everybody's narrative that really, you know, makes everything so messy and so nebulous. So I like that everything is sort of like left up to your interpretation, as theater should be. And they really, really capitalize that on that in this show, masterfully, and not in a way that's too gimmicky. So I want to
speak towards a point that Iman made, because I think that obviously with Hamilton coming out this past weekend, I think a lot of discourse has been dredged up from when the show was popular 4 or 5 years ago. And look, I'm not saying that Hamilton is without criticism. Like, there are certain, you know, things you can poke and prod with the way the show is written. but I think one of the biggest points people are making is like, you know, you're glorializing the founding fathers. You're glorializing slave owners and people who were not necessarily paragons of humanity. In particular, you know, Cabinet Battle 1, Hamilton really lays into Jefferson for slavery when George Washington, who is really just this beacon throughout the show, was a slave owner himself. And I agree with the points that are being made. But that being said, I don't know how you all feel. I personally never feel that, unless it's narrated by Ken Burns, a piece of entertainment should never be taken as a history book, should never be taken as like a dissertation. You know, there is always going to be, much like we talk about interpretation from the performer's part, there's interpretation on the creator's part. Shannon just spoke about it, how Hamilton's like, yeah, this didn't really happen. You know, Philip Schuyler was not like one of three. He was one of like nine. But they decided to truncate that for dramatic purposes. And that happens with nearly every piece of historical based works that you'll check out. And so I personally, again, maybe it's me defending the show too vociferously, but I sort of blanch at the people who are like, well, this isn't historically accurate. It's not meant to be. I love 1776. That has, in my opinion, my favorite book of any musical that's ever happened. But even that, which is literally about a historical moment, is vastly ahistorical. So it just seems like, you know, if you're trying to watch the show for that, you're not going to get that out of that, or really any piece of pop culture, right, in my opinion.
Right. And it wouldn't exist in the fashion that it does. If that was the point of Hamilton, Hamilton wouldn't be Hamilton. At the risk of sounding insensitive, I mean, I understand the certain level of, I understand the reservations that some people may have. They don't like that. We're especially during this point, like, we're kind of like at a fever pitch right now in this country with, all of the shit that's going on with Trump and all the shit that's going on with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so a lot of people are striving for a correct interpretation and an honest, like people want people to be honest about the shit that this country has, like the origins of this country. It's a very, very bloody, messy, racist history in this country. Like, no one can deny that. But I also feel like trying to take out all of the nuance in Hamilton that is clearly trying to make a statement about the history of this country, given the blind casting. I feel like you're really missing the point when you're trying to focus a lot on the history and not so much what is actually being said. And also, I feel like you're discrediting, the two things can be true at once, right? Like Hamilton and the rest of his conspirators and most of the people in the United States at that time were racist. They engaged in racist activities. That is just that the white supremacy was there. Okay. It just was. But the love that Hamilton had, the love life that he had, the social prowess that he incorporated in getting to the point, getting to the level of stature that he had, the enemies that he made, all of that still exists, even in the face of the horrendous nature of racism. So I feel like just you can't talk about one and not talk about the other. And I think that Hamilton, more than anything, is a show that is willing to talk about both. So I feel like it's sort of like you're missing the point if you are going to talk solely about like how accurate the history is. And because I feel like it's a show that's extremely honest about what's going on. So that's an interesting point that people are trying to make.
And even looking in terms of, you know, not even our real world, in the fantastical world, and musicals that have taken stories that we've all been familiar with and put different spins on them. The Wiz, Wicked, Into right. the Woods, you know, stories that we all know, but they're interpreted in a different way. And it's not about, oh, well, you weren't accurate to the original story. They are all trying to make their own statements, and they all do it in their own unique way. And I feel like something like Hamilton being able to do what it does and make us think, I mean, even just looking visually at the cast, I didn't even really factor that in. You know, again, like I've said, theater is suspension of disbelief, and I was really drawn into the characters. I know that, you know, Leslie Odom Jr. does not look anything like Aaron Burr, but I still saw him as Aaron Burr, and I right. still, that's you know, what I'm like, was able like, to get mm-hmm, the story mm-hmm. through what, you know.
That's what I'm like. That's such an absurd about, so. Position to take, because like you're on and on about like how like some of the things in, you know, what happened wasn't necessarily historically accurate, but you're not talking about the fact that Hamilton is played by a Latino American and Aaron Burr is African American, and like I mean, like, are we really gonna? Is that the hill that you want to die
also
on
didn't
here?
Rap
like,
is the go-to line, right?
Right. Like the entire rap battle, the entire story is told through hip hop and R&B, an unapologetically black art form. Okay, like hello.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, during the live tweeting of the film, was retweeting historians talking about the historical discrepancy. These historical discrepancies are important. If you want to know the history, like, yeah, you want to know what's true and what isn't, but Hamilton is not pretending to be 100% accurate. There were things that wouldn't work dramatically, and it really is primarily, wholly, a work of theater. So, in terms of historical inaccuracy, I think people are missing the point if they're going with that. But just in terms of, like, the Founding Fathers debate that Mike was talking about, for me, and again, I'm a huge fan, so, you know, I don't look to criticize the musical, and I think that it does a lot of good. But for me, when I think about it pertaining to slavery, there are a few things I think about it. I think that it pushes back against that in words and in action. In words, firstly, in terms of like eulogizing or like glorifying these people, please never glorify me the way Thomas Jefferson was glorified in Hamilton. I mean, these are people that are shown as flawed. Burr is flawed. Hamilton is flawed. And it doesn't always pertain particularly to slavery, although it is mentioned. But you can extrapolate that these are flawed people, and they were definitely not perfect. Which is good, because it also criticizes narrative. Narrative in the fact that, you know, that these people have been the ones who've had their hands on the story, who've told the story. So, of course, they've come out as these shining light, godlike people. But this is trying to show that, you know, look at Burr. You know, he was reduced to just killing Hamilton. But you want to look at people as their totality, for the good and the bad. And just kind of pushing back on that notion and debunking narrative truth in and of itself debunks whether these people were godlike figures. And then we look at what those flaws were, and ding, 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 slavery is there. And the third part of that as well is that it is America then as told by America now. So
right, I think it's the quote that they use exactly in that documentary, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a big quote about it. And America then is really flawed. America now is flawed, but trying to make progress. And in terms of America then being flawed, they can't show things that are wildly untrue. These people, you know, Washington, for example, you know, he had slaves and stuff like that. That's America then, and we can't take that back, and it's wrong. But in terms of the values of the show now, it's pretty clear how it feels. It focuses on Lawrence and, like, his abolitionist dreams and what he's trying to do. It dramatizes what we hope were, you know, Hamilton's values, progressive values for the time, although still terrible in terms of slave trading. It makes that a big focus. It bookends the show. We talk about slavery in the first song. We talk about it in the last song. It is very, very important to the show. And that's all they can do. All they can do is try and make progress with the American now. And those are the words. We see the actions. They stop perpetuating the cycle of narrative that has been left to the privileged white men. They make the cast blind casting. They make it people of color to tell the story. They put them in the front seat of the narrative. And I think that shows the values of the show as much as anything can. I mean, this is not a show that is hiding or shying away from the fact that these people had slaves and were extraordinarily flawed. I think when people bring this up, they think they're catching the show out like a gotcha moment. I've consumed a lot of Hamilton content over the last 2 days. It is in every single bit of media I've consumed about it. They talk about it. They engage with it in a really intelligent way. It's core to many themes of the show, and it's pushing back against that and its values while still telling a story of the past where these things happen. So that's the way I engage with it. And obviously it's a very sensitive thing and people take from it what it will. But I think at least the values of the show is so clear, and it puts its money where its mouth is, and it actually is a catalyst for change. And how cool is art that actually makes a change and isn't just this cool piece of art, which is pretty great in itself, but is actually part of the narratives, as we've said, and is moving the story forward.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what people might be speaking towards is actually sort of a symptom of what I'll say stan culture sort of infiltrating the theater scene. And Hamilton isn't necessarily immune from it, but I think there's this idea that people, unfortunately, you know, talk about specifically with the younger generations of theater goers about how, like, they become so obsessed with the show and so obsessed with these characters that are not necessarily paragons of society. Dear Evan Hansen is a great example where, like, people look up to Evan Hansen, and Evan Hansen does some admirable things, but Evan Hansen also does a lot of shitty things. No, mm-hmm, no spoiler alert for Dear Evan Hansen. And so I think the people that are speaking towards that are maybe speaking towards, and that goes all the way back to Amon. You mentioned Rent before, like that. I feel like it started all the way back then when people were just so obsessed with the show that they were almost looking upon these people, these characters, as God and people to model themselves after. But as Shannon is saying, I think the vast majority of fans who take things, you know, with a more complex analytical eye are not looking at the show like that. Like, I do not think anyone's like, I'm going to live life like Aaron Burr.
I actually did try to live like Hamilton for a really long time, and it wasn't good, and I don't recommend.
Yeah, and that's the thing as well. And I think that's sort of what they're coming across as well. You know, Lin-Manuel Miranda has made it very, very clear that he's saying, what I want to show is how the parallels in the ills of our society and the foibles of the people who try to maintain it still exist 200 plus years today. It's not about, wow, look at how great these guys were starting a country. It's no, it was messy as hell to start this country, and the problems still reverberate today. Chris Jackson, who is like a top 10 human being in my eye, I could just watch him talk forever and ever. He had a really great point in the Undefeated piece about how, going along with that whole, like, American then told by American now, he talked about how the casting of Hamilton shows that this whole piece is not necessarily about who's behind the flag, but who made up the flag. How many black and brown voices were a central tenet of building the start of America, and the fact that they were largely, you know, not in the narrative just because of the places they were in society. And this was an opportunity for those communities to really be able to take that narrative back, in a manner of speaking, and show how core they were to America becoming the nation that it is. And that's something that has really pervaded me. I know that Leslie Odom Jr. talked about in the piece again how the reason why he signed on is because he watched the Hamilton mixtape, and it wasn't even a song. It was him watching The Story of Tonight and seeing four men of color on stage talking about friendship, talking about brotherhood. And that to him was like a moment that he said, I want to be a part of this, and I want to hold on for dear life, because this is something that is saying something truly important, even just with the palette of people who were on stage playing these roles.
Yeah. I mean, they talk about it. David Dick says, he's like, if Thomas Jefferson knew a black band was playing him, he'd be rolling over in his grave, you know? And that's how we take back the narrative. All three presidents in the original Broadway cast, Madison, Jefferson, and Washington, played by black men. And there's so much power in the things they've done with the White House and meeting Obama, like that, you know, what the progress we're trying to make now, which I think is really important. But I think that, you know, if you're trying to rationalize, how can we talk about the founding fathers and all of the problems that existed with them? You know, they did create America. So like you guys being American, like that's significant. But David Diggs has such a good line in Hamilton's America where he's like, look, Jefferson, both things have to be true. He did write all these super important documents about things that we hold true. And he also sucks. Both things are true. And I'm playing both things, you know, and all the characters are doing that. No one is saying these people aren't flawed. Even someone like Washington, you know, who is definitely like portrayed the best in the musical of the powerful men. It says he committed many errors. Christopher Jackson says there's nothing in his performance that forgives his role in slavery. He actually hangs his head when Eliza in the final song talks about her speaking out against slavery. So these things exist in the musical. But then even beyond that, these, again, are not the historical figures. I have a Burr 1800 jumper. I'm not obsessed with Burr the person. Like, I don't know that. I'm obsessed with Leslie Odom Jr.'s version of Burr. I'm obsessed with that character, the one that's seeing the room where it happens. I'm obsessed with the character that Lin-Manuel Miranda and these actors created. And you have to be able to separate the fact that this was not meant to be a history lesson, as we've said. This was meant to be theater. This is what we're becoming obsessed with. Those are the characters. Yes, and they're still really super flawed characters, but they are kind of like this new invention that takes from this really interesting historical story, and it's a bit of a different thing.
I love that they, as you said, I love that slavery was something that came up repeatedly throughout the show, because I feel like a lot of times people, when talking about, you know, racism and slavery and all of that, I feel like a lot of people are so focused on this narrative that it was just a product at the time, right? Like, this, people were what they were back then. We are so far removed from all of that. But showing these characters actually show like how they actually weren't proud of the shit that they were doing lets you know that they knew that shit was wrong back then. You know what I mean? So the fact that we're able to like have this conversation now about it, I just feel like it's such a more honest interpretation of it. And it reminds me of one of the speeches that Michelle Obama gave a few years back here in Philadelphia, actually, when she was talking about how every day she wakes up in the White House and she has to remind herself that she's waking up in a house that was built by slaves. Right. So it's like, we can never divorce ourselves of the history of this country. And I think that Hamilton is literally trying to tell you that just in a way that is accessible to everyone and in a way that it's very honest. And I think that that's something that draws me a lot to the show, because yeah, it's like letting you know, like, look, this history is bloody. History is bloody. History is violent. History is not perfect. And this is the story that we are trying to tell you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that some people criticize, they say, that it paints too good a light on these people and their approach to slavery, like Hamilton, for example. And he does have some things where he's criticizing Jefferson and stuff. I mean, it is shown that, as I've said, he had more progressive values for his time, but still terrible values in the context of which we understand now. But I don't see Hamilton in like a good slavery way. Like, so what? So he used against Jefferson. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, he's using it for his own personal gain in the cabinet battle to like try and win that battle. And as we talk about with Lawrence, they say like his dream dies with him. And Hamilton's like, yeah. Yeah, it does. Like, I'm not carrying on that dream for you. I'm going to go and do my own selfish, ambitious things. And I feel like that's probably like pretty true to the flaws of that human being and of that character. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not created as this like abolitionist. That's not like, that would be false. Like, that's not really what he was. So yeah, he uses it for his own personal gain and then he just like ignores it. Like, that is like, sounds like classic Hamilton to me.
Exactly. I want to talk about just the casting, because it really did strike me. And I do think, you know, there is some talk about like what the legacy of Hamilton has been in the past 5 years. And I do feel like the casting is one of them. I feel like you could talk to all those cast members and the vast majority of them would be like, I never expected I'd be playing blank. in a musical, just because, you know, I think it's actually come out rather recently that although the Broadway and musical theater community at large is something that tries to embrace the aspects of diversity in many aspects, it's not perfect. There have been many, many stories that have come out about, you know, practices that have been used by people both behind and in front of the stage and how much that has harmed marginalized communities. And my, what I do feel like Hamilton does so well is like give so many opportunities to all these actors that have previously gone out as like, well, I guess I'm auditioning for, you know, the one of two black guys that's going to be on in the show, and really say, no, look up on that stage. You could be playing anybody, to the point where there was a portion of time I remember in 2016 where they were putting out Hamilton casting notices and they said, yeah, if women want to apply to be the founding fathers, they can as well. And I feel like Hamilton is one of the first shows in a while that truly did say anybody can play anybody. You know, we are not looking for any particular types for any of these roles. And I feel like that speaks so much volumes in an industry like theater.
I can count on my hands maybe how many, you know, just people of color that I've seen in shows that were not playing a role that they were in because of who they were in real life. You know, I even think about my own roles in the past. Like, I've been Seaweed. I've been Collins. I've been, I can't even think, you know, I can't even think of roles that I, like, actual roles that I've gotten that have not been partly because of who I am as an African-American person. And just to see a show where anybody can be anybody, I think is really amazing to see. And it's something that can inspire younger people as well, you know, so that when they are our age and they're looking for people to play, I don't know, you know, a prince or a princess in a thing, they don't automatically associate that with a certain image. You know, they could literally be presented with that as anybody, the hero, you know, so many characters, anybody can play anybody. And I think I'm really excited to see what happens with theater in the coming decades because of how this casting has really shaped the narrative that you don't really, you know, stories are stories, and the people that can carry the stories the best, I feel like, are the people that should be able to embody those roles, regardless of who they are or not.
Yeah, I feel like it's important to note that, like, colorblind casting doesn't necessarily mean that you don't see color, right?
Right.
Because
right.
They obviously, it was obviously the statement that they were trying to make when they decided to cast mostly black and brown people in these roles that are of white and white men and women. So they were literally being like, look, we are taking the general consensus of what's been the norm in theater, and we are bastardizing it with no question, right? And so I feel like it's striving for the end goal that we all, well, that I believe that most people want, and that we all can treat each other equally, and we all can see each other for the people that we are versus like the color of your skin. But it's doing it in a way that is like very heavy handed and letting you know, like, I know exactly what's going on here. We're not going to participate in this system anymore. We're going to choose to operate outside of it. And that means that we are going to have to exclude, because I remember when the tour, when they started doing the national tour for it and the casting calls went out, I almost auditioned. I'm kind of regretting not doing it now. One day. They were saying, like, we are looking for black and brown actors. They didn't necessarily exclude white people, but they were saying we are mostly casting. So, and a lot of people had an issue with that. And I was like, well, this is like where it starts, right? Colorblind casting does not mean that we are not acknowledging the systems that we exist in. We are choosing to operate outside of that. And I've always appreciated that. Personally speaking, I remember we did in college, we did Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. And one of the reservations that I had with the show was that I was like, well, I was the sole black person in the theater company at the time. And so I was like, I just don't necessarily feel like this is the musical for me, because where's the part for me? Because I knew full well that they're not going to do colorblind casting. They didn't have to because everybody was white. They didn't have to do that. So I was like, I just feel like there isn't room for me in this show, and I kind of feel uncomfortable being on stage when I'm, you know, supposed to be a scene partners with a guy that's holding slaves and they're talking. It just didn't really make any sense to me. And then Hamilton comes out and I'm like, see, this is what I want. Yeah. This is exactly, if we're going to tell these stories, then tell them this way. And I guess I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't have the wherewithal to say it because Hamilton didn't exist at the time. But this is exactly the panacea that I was looking for at the time. And I'm just, it's so interesting. Like the year prior, because we literally did that in 2015. And then the year afterwards, Hamilton takes the world by storm. And I'm like, ugh.
Yeah,
just like I put out like energy into the universe and it came back to me.
Well, yeah, Bloody Andrew Jackson is actually a really like pertinent example, right? Because I was a part of a production as well. And that's another one that it depicts the political process. And they try to go through with a bit of like a tongue in cheek, like populism. Yeah, yeah. Like emo pop rock thing. But even then, like there's still issues inherent into it. And so you could see that a lot of shows, again, I mentioned 1776 before, have tried to like tackle the political landscape. But Hamilton has done it in such a way that like mentions the other people that were in the room at the time in a manner of speaking outright through its casting and through the voices that it chooses to amplify over let's trot out, you know, another white guy. Then that's why the King George character is so interesting, right? It's because like he's the comic relief, but the fact that he is so sparse, he appears three times over the course of the show, really shows that it's not his story. In fact, he is an ocean away and he'll make appearances, but this is not the tale of England. This is the tale of America. This is the tale of these people on stage.
But also we talk about intentionality and in terms of like the colorblind casting, like it's not done just for the sake of it, which honestly would have merit as you're talking about, Iman, like something needs to shift. But at the same time, like, there is reason. We've talked about narrative. We've talked about how we're putting the narrative into the hands of people who didn't have it. But also there's the themes of subjugation. There's the themes of the fact that King George is the only white person in the show, the only one singing like British Beatles era pop compared to like, you know, mostly hip hop, you know, and that connects to it as well. And he's the man, right? So that's what we understand. We understand like the Americans as the underdog. And we see that in terms of the casting and in terms of the music, that they're like the oppressed, they're the subjugated. Hamilton's an immigrant. But like, let's be honest, if it was really being played in a historical fashion, like those people are more privileged than 99% of the world or whatever it would be, but they're our underdogs. And that's how we understand it. So I think there's an intentionality to that. And in terms of King George as well, and all of these things have a thought process behind them. And then they also do move the needle from a societal standpoint that is also so significant.
Yeah, thank you for that point, because I was trying to make that like it's, yeah, you have all these black and brown bodies in these positions of power, and yet they're still talking about being the underdog. So it's like, okay, well then what about the people underneath you?
Yeah.
What about the people underneath them? It's like this continuous linear regression, you know what I mean? And I feel like it's the age old quote that's like, until all of us are free, none of us are free. And so the fact that they were able to tell that story with these particular people, I feel like is just like that's the wake up call. Like they're shaking the table. They're like, hello, like we all got to be in this together, y'all.
And I think, you know, in addition to the statements that it makes on race, there are also statements that are being made on gender as well, aside from just including women in the sequel. The characters of Eliza and Angelica. Yeah, exactly. They have so much power, but in such different ways. You know, the influence that Angelica yields, she is really like the one stumping for the female narrative out front. But Eliza holds so much strength from the position that he's in. Like you said, Shannon, she talked about narrative three times. She wants to be in the narrative. She's erasing herself in the narrative and she's putting herself back in the narrative. That
all
is
over the place.
she's back across the
narrative.
But it's also it's overwhelming amount of influence I don't think any other character has in this show. Right. Where like she can say, I'm the one that is visibly removing myself and putting myself back into this. And you can just listen to Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story to be like, look at the reason why Alexander Hamilton had such a legacy in the immediate years following his death is because of his wife. And I think that the strength of the Eliza character, even though, look, does Hamilton pass the Bechdel test? Probably not. But I think that the strength of characters like Angelica and Eliza do speak towards not exactly akin to the black and brown voices that helped support the revolution, but also, you know, there's the myth of Molly Pitcher, right? This sort of like ubiquitous, amorphous female figure that was so essential to the revolution. And to see these characters mm-hmm. both represented in and out of the home, being able to be so vocally representative in the decisions of this central character, I think is very pertinent to the narrative as well.
Yeah, but for me, that's why I wouldn't want it to be casting across genders, because I think it's a very different thing. And it's, again, we're not doing it for the sake of it. We're not just trying to like copy the devices of the show. For me, it's very different. Like, the people of color in the show, they don't exist in the show because the narratives weren't told by them. They were completely left out of the story, so we put the story completely in their hands. Women are in the story, they're just subjugated. I mean, Mariah Reynolds is sold and bought like property. Mm-hmm. So it's different. So the way that the show put its modern day and progressive values onto it is elevating those characters, as we've said. In terms of Angelica, it's that she, as you said, is this like force of nature, and she is outright talking about feminism. Again, that's America then, as told by America now. That's the progressive values of the show seeping into it, as they do with slavery and race mm-hmm. as well. And then in terms of Eliza, this one actually really spoke to me like in a more recent fashion in watching it now. Cause like, I'm the kind of person who was getting tweets this year about how I'm betraying feminism. Oh, these were from men, by the way, but men were telling me I'm betraying women and feminism because I changed my name because I got married. And I'm like, I think you have it wrong. Like, I think I'm allowed to make that choice. Like, that's feminism. I choose my name. You don't choose my name for me, random man on Twitter.
yes.
And I think that's like, I saw a lot of that in Eliza when I was watching it now. It's like, people could see her going back to her cheating husband as weak. And honestly, historically, it was probably due to the fact that she had like zero options and it was a couple hundred years ago, and it's probably that. But in the theme of the musical and these characters, it is a show of strength. She chooses to take his hand. That's her power and her choice. And she mm-hmm. is the one who, his whole legacy is built around what she does. He's someone who put her second to creating and safeguarding a legacy through the whole musical. And then it only exists because of her, which is ironic. So she is so strong. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure she gets the first bow of the musical. She's as much the title of Hamilton as Alexander is.
I think that, you know, they all bow at the same time, but it's because she's front and center due to the ending. That's purposeful, right? Yeah. That like it's so interesting to me that even the final number is about like Hamilton's story, but it transitions to Eliza and all the stuff that she's done. And I think that's purposeful. I believe Lin-Manuel Miranda said like he always felt this was not Hamilton's story, but Hamilton and Eliza's story. And so I think ending on that makes so much sense.
Yeah, he says as well in, where did I read? Hamilton the Revolution. See, I'm like, where did I source all of these things in the media I have consumed? But he does. He says that this is a love letter to his wife and how this only gets done because of her, that she's like the unsung hero of his story, but it's really like she's a central figure. It doesn't happen without her. She's his cheerleader. She's his harshest critic. She's all of these things that he desperately requires to make this art. And that's a strong female choice too. I think that's the thing, is like, I really love this idea of feminism. Do you want to be Angelica? Do you want to be headstrong? Do you want to be the one outright, you know, talking about what you're going to do and politically, like, That's great. And Eliza's strength is to be there for her family and to be that person who does that for Hamilton. She's the reason we're all here. She told his story. Without her, none of us are in this theater being gasped at by her, because it doesn't exist. You know, she's why we're here. And that's a really important choice. And the fact that she can make it is really progressive and feminist. And I hope that guy on Twitter is listening, because that's feminism.
Yes.
And take down of the troll who is definitely not listening to this podcast.
But it's, if we're speaking towards, you know, things that maybe we take in differently between viewings, this is something that I definitely saw differently. You know, when I watched Hamilton on stage, I had just gotten married. And now I watch it having a son. And I will admit that, like, both Dear Theodosia and the entire Philip Act 2 saga made me weep, because it's something where, and I think even Lin-Manuel and his wife Vanessa talked about this when they were live tweeting about how, like, the song reflects so differently on you when you're a parent. And I can speak to
even
that.
Even though
firsthand.
He wrote it for his dog, right?
Yeah, something like that.
I love that.
Because well, I believe it, he wrote it like the weekend his dog died or something. No, and so he wrote it in honor of that.
The reason the weekend they adopted their dog and like his aunt died. I just read
something like that. But being able to see, particularly like, that's why I find even more like renewed vigor in Eliza, is like her ability to get through all, like, her husband cheats on her son dies essentially because of her husband, and her ability to forgive. You know, you bring up a good point, Shane, that I think from societal perspective, Angelica talks about this in Satisfied to a certain extent about how I think the perspectives on, you know, unmarried women or divorced women at the time was like such an oogity boogity type of thing. But I do think that her ability to forgive him says a lot about the character and really just the remarkable amount of strength that she's been through, that essentially everyone around her left and she took the burden on being able to tell their story. And that just shows a remarkable amount of just continually pushing and pushing and taking everything that she had been given by some of the other people around her. You know, at the end, she dies, I feel like, with Hamilton's stubbornness, with Angelica's sense of speaking out and doing something with her voice that I think is a really cool aspect of the character.
Yeah, and in terms of, like, the Bechdel test, like, no one passes the Hamilton test of this musical. Like, Burr doesn't pass it in terms of everyone being connected to Hamilton. At the same time, like, I think there's some stuff there. I think the fact, and Renee Elise Goldsberry has spoken about the relationship between Angelica and Eliza and how that's the real love story. You know, I love my sister more than anything in this life. I would choose her happiness over mine every time. They're the love story. As much as it is about Hamilton, they would have given Hamilton up for each other. So I think that as much as it is about a man and it's all centered around Hamilton, there is some stuff there in terms of their relationship with each other that is apart from that and is really beautiful. Like this idea of sisterhood, you know, the three sisters, they're like the Destiny's Child of the 18th century, the Schuyler sisters. And that's like a really cool show of, yeah, female solidarity and sisterhood.
Yeah, I mean, I like that, especially when being able to watch Satisfied, and it just really shows you just how much, literally how much they are revolving around him, and sort of like being political in their own right. And, you know, the Angelica propping up Eliza for Hamilton. And it's just like, and as you said, Shannon, like the reason that we're even here is because of the fact that Eliza exists. So they like, who is really shaping the narrative here? Who is really down in the trenches? Who are the people that really face the burden of their times? And I feel like, yes, Hamilton has been through the ringer. He has done a lot. Like, he's sure. But the people that are around him, like, those are the people that are really carrying most of the weight. And so I think that, you know, that came across well in this show. So I'm like the social barometer on what feminism is. But I feel like that is a solid feminist implementation into the show.
Yeah, co-sign that completely. Well, let's pivot a little bit and talk about, you know, some of our favorite moments from the show. I'm going to put each of us on the spot here. Aaron, if you could pick one song and one character that you say is at least at this moment in your life, like the most enjoyable from your perspective, or at least like the most interesting, what would you say?
Oh, the most interesting.
Look up this damn
song. You know what? I mean, Helpless and Dissatisfied made me gasp, but I think the song I feel like that had the most impact on me was The Room Where It Happens. Because I could identify with Aaron Burr really wanting to be, you know, I feel like that The Room Where It Happens kind of represents where I am right now, just in terms of being unemployed and starting this podcast journey, being like, you know, I want to be the one in the room and speaking my truth and being able to connect with everybody on a global scale through art mediums that we have all known to come and love in the form of reality TV shows and musicals and whatever random thing I happen to see that people will actually want to talk about. So that's the one, the song for me. As far as the character, I just, for some reason, I really gravitated towards Laurent.
Oh, yeah. Lawrence, yeah.
Lawrence, yeah. Although my favorite actor that I gravitated towards was the guy who played Mulligan and Madison.
Yeah, Oak. he's awesome. He also went on to play Pierre in Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And that's one of my other favorite shows. And he killed it in that as well. But I totally agree. I think he's like, he was one of those people that like, I gained so much more admiration for him and his characters. The more I like, I mean, what he did with Hercules Mulligan in particular, sort of like taking this like gravelly DMX take onto it into like this very subdued, smooth James Madison in Act Two is like a really well done differentiation between the two characters.
Everyone was amazing, though. I mean, the whole Rat Pack, Lawrence and Lafayette and Mulligan, like they were hilarious. And that's something that you lose as well from the soundtrack, that it's that funny. And like, what a vibe.
What a vibe. All right. It was. Yeah.
Amon, putting the spotlight onto you now. Highlighted song and character for you.
This is tough. I think I probably have to go with History Has Its Eyes on You. Only because, I mean, it's sort of like a warning for Hamilton, right? You know, Washington's telling him, like, you know, like, I am in this position now. I have all of this power, but like, I don't necessarily have the greatest story either. Like some of my first battles that I fought, I led plenty of men into war. I've seen many of my allies die, and so history will be watching you, and you really have to make sure that you choose your steps carefully. I think it's something that kind of resonates with me at this particular time in my life. Yeah, it's a sad song, but it's also like, you know, it's Hamilton's first starting out. You know what I mean? It's like, if you want this business, then be ready for it. So like, I really resonate with that. As far as highlighted character, I think I'm going to go for Angelica just because she is somebody that, I really appreciate characters that are able to step outside of themselves and realize the bigger picture, because I feel like a lot of the time the audience's job is to do that, but she did it for herself. And so I really like that. Satisfied is just probably one of the strongest songs in the show. While it's not like my favorite, I just think that it's just such a powerhouse performance by that character. So I think I like Angelica the most.
All right, Shannon, the biggest Hamill fan on the panel. Let's have you really pick your poison here.
Well, for me, as I said, the musical resonated with me over the last couple of years so much because of the central conflict of restraint and ambition. And as I've said, this is the most ambitious I've ever been in the last couple of years, you know, and I kept telling my brother, I'm like, I'm not throwing away my shot. I don't say no to anything. That's the point, right? Like I'm channeling Hamilton. And he was like, you know, the point of that is that he pushed too far and then he died. And I'm like, well, that's not what I took from it. Okay. The point is that you can never go too far. You keep pushing. You never say no. You never throw away your shot. But before every opportunity I've had in the last couple of years, I've listened to my shot and jumped around and gotten that energy out. But that's not the song I'm going to choose, because I found out that there's a problem with pushing too far and with that reckless ambition. I mean, I'm not trying to like create America here. I'm just trying to create a podcast, but sometimes it feels like I'm running out of time. And for me, I was like, I don't even like Hamilton as a character. Why do I identify with him so strongly? That's so problematic for me. I'm Team Burr. And I think in the last couple of months, I've finally got it. So I would say my song is Wait For It. And my character is Burr because I finally get it. You want to be ideally in that middle ground, probably between Burr waiting for it and Hamilton not throwing away his shot. But for me, I finally get it to step back and wait for it and take a little bit of a breath. And that song for me, I think, is one of the best songs ever written. But when I put it on, I just like, especially at the end when it just kind of goes into that melody, that piano melody underneath the lyrics, and I can just breathe again. And so for me, that's what I'm choosing. And it really has been so significant to me in that like central conflict, ambition and restraint. I think Angelica, she has that ambition to Eliza's restraint, the different sides of the same coin of this like universal duality that the human condition just has. And I think that's one of the most powerful parts of the musical. And I know it's something that I've been wrestling with for a couple of years and I'm still kind of wrestling with. But right now I would say Wait For It. And that's something that makes me happy.
Yeah, Wait For It is a song that I previously thought, and I still think it's probably the best song. It definitely is like one of the songs I feel like, as again, accessible as the hip hop R&B for the most part soundtrack is, Wafer is that song. I feel like you could snatch it, change some lyrics, put it on the radio right
Why
now.
Is it not on
it'll
the
be
radio?
Like a top 40 hit.
Why is it on the radio? So
I mean, it was on the radio for some time, actually, with the whole Hamilton mixtape that actually came out being remixed by other pop artists.
It was Usher.
I remember Usher sang it. Yeah, and it's, God, it's so good. But I love that song
as
well.
The mixtape, Ashanti and Ja Rule's version of Helpless, it's so good. Anyway.
Kelly Clarkson Kills is Quiet Uptown. Check out the Hamilton mixtape if you haven't yet. But I think why I love Wait For It is because it's like, you know, musical theater has their I want songs, right? Where the character is like, this is what I want. And now I'm going to now work towards it. And this is sort of like an I want song, but the I want song is like, you know, I want to restrain myself, which is so antithetical to so much we know about musical theater, that that format breaking is so interesting. The Burr character, I will co-sign what Chan said about the Burr character. For me, the Burr character is probably, like, I think Eliza is probably, like, the best character in terms of just what she does. She does so many awesome things. She's the best character, but Aaron Burr to me is the most interesting.
She so much as well.
Yeah, but Aaron Burr to me is the most interesting character, because there is so much, despite the story, again, not being about him, there is power in the fact that he's the one that does so much narration. You know, all the how does a blank stuff comes from him, whether it's from the beginning, whether it's him transitioning certain things. Like, he is pretty much the narrator the entire time. And then if you go to the world was wide enough, and they go into the duel, like, they do so much great. Like, I love that that's all told from his perspective. You know, that the whole 10 Duel Commandments reprise is entirely from what he perceives and why he did what he did. I always break when Leslie Odom Jr. says, I only had one thought before the slaughter. This man will not make an orphan of my daughter. Not only does Leslie Odom Jr. break, but it also shows, again, like, the convictions of why Burr did what he did. As he says, like, I'm the villain in your history book. But I think one of the biggest accomplishments of the show is that it takes us inside the mind of Aaron Burr and really makes us realize, like, okay, what drove him to end up feel like he had to shoot Alexander Hamilton right there, right then? You know, what was their relationship? And why did he feel so compelled to do this when he really did hit rock bottom after the election of 1800? I'm going to go. This is a tough one. I think combined with the visuals, I'm going to go. This is going to be an outside pick because you all listed songs that I absolutely love. I'm going to go with Yorktown. And it's a weird choice, but I remember watching it and then watching it on the Tony Awards in 2016, and then watching it again. And I feel like as a composite of, like, lyricism, musicality, and stagecraft, I just think it is brilliant. There is something about the end of the song when they're all standing up on the chairs and the stools and, you know, freedom for America, freedom for France, got to start a new nation, got to meet my son. And there's this one moment where Oak just yells, like, we won. And, like, all the voices join in. I don't know, that's something that continually gives me goose pimples. It really does right now, literally as I'm saying it, and just, like, makes my heart soar. And I think it does apply to, again, a lot of stuff going on today about making your voices heard and being the scrappy fighters, but keep pushing forward knowing that there will be a tomorrow, and tomorrow will be better as long as you keep doing what you're doing. And it's a message that has really resonated with me, on top of just some killer choreography, that badass Hercules Mulligan killer dance break as well. Like, it's a fantastic piece. I know that people were mystified a bit of, like, why did they do that for the Tonys? Why didn't they do Alexander Hamilton? But, like, it was 2016. We heard Alexander Hamilton done, like, 15 times. I heard it done by, like, the Batman as a parody. Yorktown is such a random ass piece of theater spliced in the middle of Act One, but it is such a big piece in general that, like, I always gravitate back towards it as one of my favorites.
Yeah, and in Hamilton's America, Lin-Manuel Miranda is, you know, it goes through him creating the show, and he's like, at this current stage, we're about to start rehearsals, I just had a kid, and my entire life depends on my current project doing well. I am in Yorktown right now. And I know that some people criticize Lin-Manuel Miranda in terms of maybe, like, his singing ability or his acting. Like, I thought he did great, but, like, for me, it's more that he, like, embodies Hamilton. Like, he wrote Hamilton in what he was seeing, in terms of, like, his dad was an immigrant, so he took from that, and he saw himself in this character, and that's the character that he invented, and he saw his own struggles in it, in writing it. And I think Yorktown, as you said, it perfectly illustrated where he was when he was creating the musical and so many other parts of that. As we've said, he connects to it. You know, he wrote Dear Theodosia for his dog. And one of the things he says he couldn't write was It's Quiet Uptown, because thank God he hasn't lost a child. But it was only when he thought of the line, there are moments that the words don't reach, where he was like, oh, I don't have the words for this, that he could write it. And that was the one he struggled with the most. Other songs, even though it is about the American Revolution and the foundation of America, he was taking from very personally. So for me, it is a joy to see Lin-Manuel Miranda in the role of the movie. Like, it would feel wrong for me not to see that, because it's his Hamilton, and I really appreciate getting to see him in that role.
Yeah, guys, what do you think about that? Because again, like, we're all musical theater performances, so I'm sure we all, you know, wince a little bit when we get Gerard Butler as the Phantom of the Opera or Russell Crowe as Javert. And not to say that Lin-Manuel Miranda is on any similar page as them, but I think even he would be the first to admit, like, I do not have the best singing voice. Does your perception of the character or the show affect it at all by, you know, maybe Lin's passion and his expert rapping ability as compared to maybe songs like Hurricane or even his verse in It's Quiet Uptown, where it's less so about maybe the tonal quality of his voice?
You know, there's a saying, never bring a composer to the first rehearsal. But I do think there's something to be said of the person that wrote the music and the lyrics also being involved in the project and embodying their own artistic creation, because there's something that they can bring to it that nobody else can, because there's a through line of a vision throughout the whole thing. And, you know, not everybody's going to have all the tools to execute what they create, you know, in the most perfect way. But with what we do have, I think is a perfect lens into how this story resonated with him, how this musical has been something that he has been working on for years and years and years, and really seeing everything come out, you know, what appears effortlessly, but I'm sure took a lot of, you know, late nights to create. So that's something that I know that I can appreciate, and I do think that that's a unique opportunity that we don't often get to see composers in their own works, you know, kind of hearing it how they envisioned it.
I feel similar to that. There were definitely moments where I felt I was listening and I was like, ooh, this song's a little shaky for him. Lin, you might want to take that down. Like, there were moments where I was like, this is a little weird. But if there is anybody that I am willing to accept that for, it would be Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, as Aaron just said, he took 6 years to write this, right? He's already involved. This is his shit. The book is by him. The lyrics are by him. Like, it's just, come on. So I felt like there are a lot of people that might think that it's just a little bit too self-indulgent. You're too self-involved. Like, you want to be, you're writing and now you're trying to be an actor too. And I think that his performance was great. You know, the songs weren't always there, but the performance was great. And then I, like Aaron just said, I think that there isn't often a time where we get to see someone who creates, who writes, also to be a part of the project. And I think that it's a rare opportunity, because it is sort of like what he envisioned. And even that is going to change. You know what I mean? As he continues to, with each performance, everything changes. So I was fine with Lin-Manuel. I think that he is one talented guy. And I mean, just, you know, take some more breathing exercises and some singing lessons. You'll be all right.
Yeah, work that diaphragm, Lin. I will put out there, you know, and this is a bit of like a musical theater basic bitch opinion, but I have always felt Stephen Sondheim is probably the best musical theater lyricist of all time. And I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is very easily getting up there. Like, read that Hamilton, the Revolution book, or like look up the lyrics on Genius if you have not, because there's just so much depth to each and every word that he puts in there. And there's, you know, references to other musicals in there. Like you said, like, there's something for the musical theater fans. There's reference to The Last 5 Years and 1776 and South Pacific. Like, he is such a musical theater nerd, but also like has, he's also a bit of a hip hop nerd as well. And so not only does he sort of cram things full of the influences that have put him where he is today, but there are so many, especially in Hamilton, like so many callbacks and call forwards and reverberating themes, like the fact that Hamilton says, uses the word helpless to describe his mother, his wife, and his lover.
A lot of stuff
super interesting. It's a freaking novel. It really is. So I really encourage people, like, take the time to check out the layers, because even separate of like the beautiful melodies that these singers bring to it, just the pure poetry that he has brought to these characters is unbelievable, in my opinion. So nuanced and so layered, to the point where, like, if people watch this again, please watch it with the subtitles on, because I guarantee you, you did not catch things the first time, that you will this time around. That's just incredibly fantastic wordplay.
That's one thing that I was really glad from watching it, because I was like, oh, thank goodness I'm watching this for the first time with the ability to have subtitles. Because I remember back in 2016, there is this article from the Wall Street Journal where they took the lyrics and broke them down and, you know, took a look at the rhyming scheme and really broke down the lyrics in some of the songs and the influences from various genres of music. I'll give a link to this because it's a very interesting article. But seeing some of those same lyrics from that article in Vision here and being able to pick up on a lot of the details, I was like, there is no way I would have picked this up live, and being able to read, I'm like, it just made it that much more impactful to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like Hamilton is like, he's Lynn to a degree. Like, why do you write like you're running out of time? Like, he's talking about himself. He does say that he does, like, Burr resonates for him, and like, I'll believe it if he says it, but like, he clearly is like, Hamilton is Lin-Manuel Miranda to a degree. There's a reason he cries when he writes Best of Wives and Best of Women, because as he said, he dedicates it to his wife and he sees Eliza in that. And it's pretty obvious that he's coming from like a pretty first person account to a degree. But there's so much cool detail, like having, you know, read Hamilton, the Revolution. I'm pretty sure it's available on ebook, or just like reading Lin-Manuel Miranda's tweets, or like all of these things that give extra detail, like so many extra details. For example, why is What Did I Miss in jazz? Because Jefferson's been in France. Like, no one's caught him up to the fact that we're rapping now. Like, things like that is really, really fun. Or the fact that, like, at the beginning of The Room Where It Happens, that's the most monosyllabic you're going to get Hamilton. He's just saying yes and no to Burr for a while. Because he's got Mariah Reynolds on the brain. Like, things like that, where every single thing is thought about in all of these details, and there's so much good stuff there. So, yeah, it's just a brilliant plot, isn't it?
I don't feel like people would be as amenable to listening to him if he wasn't Hamilton either. You know what I mean? I feel like there's, because at the end of the day, we exist within a celebrity culture, and whoever, if it wasn't Lin-Manuel playing Hamilton, it would have been some other Broadway upstart, which I'm sure would have been talented and wonderful, but that person would have gotten all the praise. The rest of the cast would have gotten all the praise. And of course, Lin-Manuel would have had, you know, his shine and everything, because we have also like extended the idea of celebrity to producers and writers and all of that. But I feel like him being the face of it, him being on that stage, and then, you know, like, as you said, like reading his tweets and all, knowing that he has been in this, it starts with him and it ends with him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I feel like people are more susceptible to listening to what he has to say because of the fact that he is the face of the show. So, yeah, once again, props to Lin-Manuel.
Yeah, I meant to make a Hamilton pun. Hamilton. I don't know if we've
you got it in right under the wire. We could go on for so much more about this show, but I do want to start to wrap things up. And again, I'm going to throw out that loaded question here as we sort of go around the panel here. Having now recently seen Hamilton in whatever capacity that we've taken it in previously, Aaron, give me your final thoughts. What does this show mean to you in this moment? And what will you take with you from this viewing, your first viewing of Hamilton, you know, moving forward in the near future, at least?
There are musicals throughout history that have just, you know, been very popular from, you know, or the second they came out, or have been big in history. I think of Oklahoma. I think of Rent. I think of Book of Mormon recently. Wicked. Hamilton is one of those. And being able to access it in this kind of a medium, I'm so glad because, mm-hmm. you know, in a situation where we're globalized, I think this is one of the first times that something of this scale has had as much accessibility and as much universality. I don't even, is that a word? as Hamilton. And I am so glad to be alive when this has come out and to have experienced it myself and to see, you know, people. I love to see America represented on stage when we're talking about America. And I'm really glad that we've seen, you know, black and brown and white and all in between, you know, all of that representation. Characters, female characters that were amazing. Like it didn't matter who they were or what they were or what they looked like or what they did. You know, I mean, I'm raving about the Bullet. And that person's in the ensemble. Like, what kind of show can you do that with? I don't know. I'm so glad for Hamilton. And I really do hope that musicals that come out in the future that kind of ignite on this same scale are able to do something similar. And it doesn't have to be a historical play. It could be anything. You know, and that's what I'm excited about is theater that's not exactly rooted in any one identity. It's just a story that we all connect with, told by people that represent us as the world. And it's not just one particular image. That's what I'm ready for. And that's what I'm excited for. And that's what I look forward to seeing.
Shannon?
I think, well, I mean, having seen it and been obsessed with it for a long time, what I want to take from the Disney Plus viewing is that accessibility and the fact that it should be accessible, right? It's about the underdog. It's not about everyone who can get to whatever show and pay for the ticket. And in a pandemic, when so little feels accessible, that accessibility is like such a gift. I know there's probably a bit of debate, like what will this do to theater? People are watching in their living rooms. Will they go to live theater? Will they go see these actors in their craft? And I think, and I hope yes. Like for me growing up in South Africa, I wasn't going to the theater. That wasn't really a thing. It's still not a huge thing, as I've said, in Australia, even though I do try to go as much as I can. And for me, like it was my grandma's videotape of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. That musical film made me obsessed with musicals, and I ended up doing my wedding first dance to a song from Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. No regrets on that. So I do think film is a catalyst to make people love theater even more. Like I don't think anyone wouldn't see it just because they've seen it in their living room. I think that would be the wrong decision. But I also think that they won't just go and see Hamilton when they might have otherwise not have known about it. They'll go see other things. They'll become obsessed, hopefully, with musical theater across the board. So that accessibility is important. The accessibility that people will get in schools to these themes. I'm jealous. I'm not in high school right now. Today, when I was writing out my notes, I'm like, I feel like I'm back in high school English, and it's so much fun, and I wish I could use this as a related text for high school. But I can't. But like having it in education, I think is like a really big thing. And then like beyond that, what is it going to teach people in high schools? What is it going to teach people who have access to it? What is it going to teach these new people who love theater and love it? It's going to teach them that history has its eyes on us, that we're part of the story, that we're all part of this, you know, revolution. These themes are timeless. And, you know, this is something that it resonates for us for a reason. Because yes, it's a couple hundred years ago, but it's still pretty prevalent now. So it teaches us to be beyond ourselves, to be greater than ourselves, to be the best versions of ourselves, sometimes by teaching us what not to do. And I think a lot of lessons are going to be learned. A lot of clarity and assurance is going to be had through this piece of art that's now available to everyone. And I love that. I love that I can share it with more people. I love that I can go right now and watch bits of it before I go to sleep, which I definitely will. There's a problem I'm going to have with the fact that this is at my fingertips. It's like not a healthy thing. I'm just really happy that we have it. And I just loved it so much.
All right, Aman.
Yeah, it means a lot of things for me. I mean, I echo all of the sentiments about, you know, accessibility and how everyone should have a chance to see this. But also that art is important. Art is very powerful. It is something that does change minds and change hearts and shift consciousness and push history forward. And the way that this was done, with seeing so many people that look like me up on that stage and then being rewarded for it at the Tony Awards, it's just like greater affirmation that the people that are continuously trod upon for whatever reason, they have lives, they have stories, they have existences just like anybody else. And yeah, they told this story of Alexander Hamilton, but it can be anything, really. Like Aaron was talking about earlier, it can really be anything. And if the storytelling is good, if the writing is good, people will come to see it no matter what they look like. So many people came. I mean, we had that whole story about Mike Pence coming to one of the shows. And while a lot of people weren't necessarily pleased to see him there, I have to imagine that he watched that show and left with something. You know what I mean? So I feel like, yeah, art is very, very important when it comes to change. And it's such a powerful tool. And I am glad that people are giving it a shot. And it deserves all of the hype. The only one small selfish critique that I will have for Hamilton, and I completely understand why they did this, obviously, but this is just my own selfish, thirsty self. I just wanted one more Jonathan Groff song. Just one more.
Aww.
Just
one more. What about the spit, Amon?
The spit was, I mean, he could have left that backstage, but everything else.
Oh my goodness.
The close up on it as he's doing, I can't believe it.
It doesn't help that, like, because the King George choreography or lack thereof is so static that, like, there's like, let's close in on his face. And so you get, like, the full SeaWorld show, essentially, and that's one of the big talking points. But
Lottery winners are definitely getting drenched, I think.
Oh my god, they need ponchos, Hamilton brand ponchos for that. What I love about this is, you know, I love the fact that they bumped this up, because theater is a communal experience. Since the days of the ancient Greeks, it was about going and, like, experiencing something with however many people are in the room with you that you know, like, will never happen again in this certain perspective. You're watching something truly unique. You're watching a snowflake fall onto the ground that only you and a certain amount of people can talk about. And I do feel like, due to recent months, you know, we have been so separated in so many ways. We've been, for very, you know, understandable reasons, we've had to, you know, live out so much independently or withdrawn within ourselves. And this is an opportunity to really re-explore, like, what is it like to be in the audience, albeit virtually, of this show? And that's why I agree with you, Aaron. Like, I love the audience noises. And granted, they're not over the top like when they did Legally Blonde on MTV that one time and they piped in all the wooings and hootings and hollerings. Like, you get reminded that there's an audience sometimes, and it makes you truly feel like you're a part of this communal group. What I really loved experiencing this time around is sort of using this as like a referendum on what's happened the past 5 years. In The World Was Wide Enough, Hamilton says, legacy, what is a legacy? It's planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. And Hamilton has been able to see the seeds grow. But the thing I'm honestly most excited for with Hamilton is how inspired people will be by it. Even looking to something like A Strange Loop, which is a very new show by Michael R. Jackson that just won the Pulitzer Prize for drama. And not to say that it's direct, offspring of Hamilton, but my hope is that in watching a show succeed that is so counterculture to the Broadway narrative in so many ways, between its casting and its musical and its themes, my hope is that for the people who have the bucks in their pocket from a producing perspective, exactly, it helps them look towards those other stories that they might have glanced over before and says, well, look, we took a chance on Hamilton. Like, let's give people stories that they want to hear. And not, no offense to Music Man fans out there, but let's not do Music Man for the 1400th time. Let's look to new stories that are being told from new voices. And because very much the discourse nowadays in our culture is about amplifying the voices of those that felt like they haven't been given a microphone for so many years. Mm-hmm. Let's turn those body mics on.
Literally in the middle of a pandemic right now about, like, you know, aside from the coronavirus, but like as far as Disney is concerned, it's like remake after remake after remake after remake after remake after remake. It's like, come on, like there are so many more stories out there that we can tell that like are going to do well. And it's just so fascinating to see somebody like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who worked for this painstakingly for 6 years, and to see it pay off like this is just so inspiring. And I feel like I hope that not only, like you said, that people that have the money will put it behind other shows, but I also hope that people that do have stories to tell, people that are writers, if there are any writers that are listening to this, keep writing, keep doing it, keep at it, be bold, be tenacious, don't stop. Like you, like it, because it can happen for you. Like the world is changing. If you have a story, learn how to tell it and keep telling it. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's just something to add to that.
And one more thing I'll say before we start giving our plugs here. So the unfortunate news, which I guess is linked with Hamilton being a part of the Broadway community, is that this past week, Broadway announced that it would be closing for the duration of 2020. Mm-hmm. And while completely, again, understandable, given the health and safety guidelines that are permeating our country today, that puts so many people out of work. And I do believe that unemployment, at least from the arts perspective, is ending in a couple of weeks. So I really do implore people out there, and I've seen it, you know, proliferating my social media as well, but I want to amplify this point that, you know, if you watched Hamilton and you enjoyed it and you watched through the credits and you saw every single person who contributed to that production, all these people are in trouble right now. They are without jobs. They are without a living. And so I really, really would implore all of you to, you know, reach out to your senators. Go to BroadwayCares.org and donate to the COVID-19 Emergency Assistance Fund, mm-hmm. because all of these artists who we all value, for one, you know, from whether it's watching Hamilton, whether it's watching a TV show, whether it's listening to a piece of music, this all comes from an artist who right now is going through so much difficulty with their livelihood essentially yanked out from underneath them. And, you know, if there's any way we can support them, look up other ways you can support local artists in your community as well. Hell, find an artist you like, Venmo them if you want to. Every little bit helps, mm-hmm. I guarantee. And it's going to help the artist community at least stay afloat, so that when 2021 comes around, when Broadway opens back up and when theaters around the country open up, that means that they're going to be able to produce such sublime content as what we just talked about, and even more stuff to come. But it can't come without our help as well. We need to do the
denormalize starving artists. Denormalize starving artists. Why do Amen. Artists have to starve? Fuck that.
Amen. Should not be.
Amen. Well, to finish things off, you know, first off, I have to thank you all profusely for sharing your stories with Hamilton In and Out. I can legitimately say this is one of my favorite conversations I've had in quite some time.
Me
and
too.
I absolutely adore talking with all of you about this and what the show means to you guys. But I also know you guys are talking a lot into microphones about all other types of stuff besides Hamilton. So we'll go through the panel again. If you want to give out your social media handle and any other stuff you might be podcasting about or writing about or hell singing about, I don't know, at this day and age. Shannon, let's start with you.
Well, I'm not doing a lot. Like, I'm waiting for it. You know, I'm not falling behind or running late. I am standing still at the moment, actually. But yeah, I'm not doing a lot of podcasting. You can find me at Shannon Gates. I did do a panel with Rob and the Survivor Specialist and Lauren Ashley Beck about where Survivor is at the moment. So you can still catch that because it's still pretty relevant. That was last week. That's just on RHAP. But otherwise, yeah, I'm not doing a ton. But I've loved, as Mike said, having this conversation. I love talking about Hamilton. I love talking with you guys about it. Like, for theater nerds,
yes,
you guys, I think, have more on the credit list than just Hebrew Simba, but none of you have been Hebrew Simba, right?
So no,
nope.
to talk to you guys about like your love of theater and your experience with it has been super, super fun, especially centered around Hamilton, which, as I've said, is like, you know, one of the greatest works of art, if not the greatest of my lifetime. I really love it so much. I've loved this conversation. Thank you for having me.
I'm on.
Yeah, you can find me at Amon Adwin on Twitter. I, of course, cover Drag Race for RHAP if there are any Drag Race fans. And I also have a Glee rewatch podcast that Mike has guested on twice. We're in the middle of recording for season 4. We just dropped all of season 3. So if there's any Gleeks out there, you can find us in the choir room on Twitter. Yes, yes, yes. And yeah, just echoing with Mike said, what Shannon said as well, I enjoyed this conversation a lot. And theater has always been a big part of my life. And as I've gotten a little older, it's sort of had to take a bit of a back seat. But, watching this again has really sort of like reignited that passion for me. And I hope that, last year I was able to do a show. This year, obviously, with the pandemic, all the auditions that I did have gone up, up in the wind. But I'm hoping that in 2021, I am able to make a return to the theater, because it's just something that I feel like I cannot live without. And watching this has really just, helped me rediscover that. So I've enjoyed my time.
Aaron.
You can find me on Instagram at @theorange_AA, all written out. @theorangedoublea. And then on Twitter, I'm @aarobertson94. And as Mike mentioned earlier, I am currently hosting the Karma Recaps, where I'm hosting with a panel of Endurance alumni. Got Monroe from season 3, Keaton from season 2, Lily from season 5, who worked on Karma, and we've all been talking about Karma, and we were able to interview pretty much the entire cast. So
amazing.
So those episodes are coming out, so definitely check that out. And yeah, you can find me in Wandoffs. I'm almost nearing my 100th, which I did not believe was going to happen when I first started.
Amazing. Why do you write Wandoffs like you're running out of time?
People come to me and they ask, and I do it, and I'm not throwing away my shot for that. So. Oh my,
you guys also did the Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat Wandoff. You've done all the best Wandoffs.
Yeah.
Jacob Aaron. Right? That was so good. So good.
I also hosted the Rise and Fall series with Nick Fishman, where we covered old reality shows, what worked and what didn't work. I write musical themes for people. So I recently did one of the themes for Podquester's new show, Brown Girl Breakdown. Check that out. Just doing all the musical things. So if you need composing things, you can come into me and I'll make something.
You can follow me @amikebloomtype. I do podcasting about Lost here on the Post-Show Recaps Network on RHAP proper. I'm doing the RHAP B&B, going through past Survivor seasons, doing Top Chef. Going to do some Tough as Nails coverage with Rob Cesarino and Jessica Lease as I prepare myself to be tough as nails as I get a Survivor tattoo later on. There's a bunch of random stuff involving me out there in the ethos, if you are so inclined to check that out. But I want to thank each and every one of you for
the casualness of before I get my Survivor tattoo.
It's become real from my perspective. We made the appointment, so it has become real now. So now that it's actually coming into focus. But I want to thank each and every one of you for listening as well, whether you are like a theater casual or a diehard Hamilton fan. If you have stuff you want to talk with us about regarding Hamilton or any of the subjects you discussed, definitely reach out to us on social media. We'd be happy to engage in some more discourse, because again, we have only scratched the surface of just the iceberg that this show is. And I want to again thank profusely Shannon, Ahmad, and Aaron for all the fantastic insights they've been able to provide about Hamilton. Who knows? Maybe we'll find opportunities to talk about more stuff in the future. Let us know. Who's to say the world is wide enough, hopefully, for a bunch of musical theater talk here on Post Show Recaps. But that's going to do it for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. Take care. Bye-bye. Who tells your story?